My Life as an Animal, Serialization, Week 8. This episode is brought to you by animalaid.org.uk, who campaign peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promote cruelty-free living.
It's now time to continue our audiobook here on UK Health Radio, My Life as an Animal, written by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith.
My Life as an Animal. But who was going to do something to stop the destruction beyond moaning about it with like-minded Heath regulars? The who turned out to be Sarah, and it was a smart and relentless campaign of opposition she led. Doomed trees were marked with a cross so that the scale of the planned destruction was visible at a glance. There was a well-supported petition, and news updates were sent to a list of supporters. Coverage of the case against was featured in local newspapers and, critically, the Corporation of London was drawn into explaining itself in detailed written exchanges and then pressed into staging a series of open meetings during which they began to sound less and less confident in their reasoning. There was no formal declaration to say the tree felling plan has been scrapped, but it was scrapped. And hundreds of trees and the flora and fauna that coexisted with them was saved. Shuffling through those red box pieces, I wondered what my grand plan had been. Or was I just trying to get published and earn a living? Let me summarise one more batch of articles and then ponder what else there is to ask. For the Evening Standard's ES magazine, there was the drama-filled story of Big Jill McCabe, who slept on the streets like her twin Michael and was someone I kept in touch with for around 8 years before she disappeared. She showed me her world and her friends, and reminded me how short is the distance between the average well-integrated citizen and a hard, cold pavement for a bed. I would try, every so often, to find something inconsequential and cheery to write about. A couple of pieces I did for the Evening Standard fitted the bill. One was about sweets. The big question was, which of the old jaw-rotting 60s classics survived from a list that has to include blackjacks, love hearts, licorice straps, shrimps, 8-a-penny aniseed balls, flying saucers and jawbreakers? A follow-up question was, do the children of the 90s have as discerning a palate for marvellously confected junk as the satchel swingers of earlier decades? Not settled. The other light piece returned me to Petticoat Lane Market at the back of Liverpool Street Station, where as a bony 14-year-old I sold shoes from a stall every Sunday. How was my spiel and patter all these years later? Could I command a crowd and flog them soft toys, such as the £2 teddy bear in a wicker basket, all dolled up in lace, or pregnant Fiona, whose removable offspring was spookily lodged in her pink plastic belly? It turns out I was hopeless at it. So hats off to the stall owner, Graham Breslaw, a singular man who got to the market at 3 a.m. to allow himself 4 hours to lay out the stall. Among numerous news features I did for The Guardian was Past Master in the Present, The Last Stand of Solomon Goldstein. It was the story of a deeply eccentric 75-year-old Marxist activist and one-time celebrated street orator. He was, by the time we called on him, the only remaining Jewish resident in East London's Brick Lane, once a thoroughly Jewish milieu. The accompanying photo was wonderfully atmospheric and perfectly executed. It showed Solomon in an armchair amidst the clutter of his Brick Lane home. He had removed and was holding his glasses and staring intently into the camera lens. Spread out on the wall behind him were ancient frame monochrome photographs of family members, including his mother and brothers. The photographer was Brian Moody, my partner on many stories, particularly for Time Out. Brian's other photographic work was mainly studio-based. The pieces we did together, for instance about rough sleepers, involved seizing the moment. They also required, particularly of the photographer, an instinct for moving about unobtrusively, but without looking furtive. Also knowing when to ask and when to just press the shutter. Brian had all of that and plenty more, and over the years produced many memorable images for the stories we worked on. For another Guardian piece, I won the trust of a Norfolk pig farmer who fed his animals swill, which could be all kinds of factory waste, but was more often the contents of rubbish bins. All of it was steam-cooked in three large adjoining troughs and left to cool. It might then have sat there for days if he sold or sent to slaughter more pigs than he bought in. The cooled slop I saw was a suppurating mess, thick with a head of fungus and still littered with chunks of crockery and the odd spoon or knife. It was outrageous that pigs were being fed such stuff. We have become so used to pigs equaling foulness and stench, we forget that we control the way they live and what they eat. Given a chance, pigs will eat a mess well away from their sleeping area. And rather than rancid swill, their preference is for roots, fruits, herbs and buds, tree shoots, mushrooms and larvae. For Esquire magazine, I followed around a high-flying brain surgeon, watched him open patients' skulls and reach inside with his steady hand. And for the magazine of the short-lived Correspondent newspaper, there was fighting for an identity, Bangladeshi gangs in the East End. And finally, two from The Observer, one on a drug-free method of managing chronic pain, the other a close-up on the new, more physical and urgent disability activism. What strikes me about that list is how much I would have had to learn and quickly about diverse topics. At a deeper level, I was seeing what it means to endure in the world for people and animals living at their physical and emotional limits. We all tremble when that thing we fear advances towards us. Will we run or stay and face it? And is facing it courage or vanity? But I could see now that in the course of writing the stories, one of the three night dream powers came to me. The power of becoming the invisible presence, watching events unfold. In this guise, you see people at their frailest and most stoical. I watch the choices people make, as well as the situations they get dropped into and what they make of them. It became my education. I could not have guessed at the time that those Fleet Street years and so much of what had gone before in my journalism, my travelling, the music, my stepping into the unknown and speaking out when called for, all of this was preparation for the work I would do for the rest of my active life.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid, home at last. Now we come to the final chapter in which I describe for you, dear listener, my 22 years at Animal Aid. I have switched to a Q&A format, partly because compared with the narrative style of the preceding chapters, Q&A is a more direct, unself-conscious way of expressing how things were or seemed to be and how we felt. But the main reason for the Q&A format was the worsening of my Parkinson's disease symptoms. Persistent pain, weakness, lack of sleep, unsteadiness on my feet. In particular, there is the punishing lower back pain that comes from, according to a 2013 MRI scan, severe degenerative disease, including the almost complete loss of disc space, disc bulges, and dehydration over most of the lumbar discs. That was 4 years ago. The degeneration continues. It means that I have often been unable simply to sit at my desk or stand at it and summon up the words and phrases I needed to tell the story. While the Q&A format also called for me to spend some time at my desk, there was far less of it. My colleague and friend, Fiona Pereira, wrote the questions, and I answered them as best I could. The result, having been purged of clumsy language and passages of wordy nonsense, is what follows. My worry when I began writing this book was that I would become too feeble or uncoordinated to finish it. I have now all but reached the end, and what a wonderful feeling that is. When I do cross the line and declare the thing done, I'll have to call it a dead heat between me and my Parkinson's. I'll settle for that.
You recently retired as director of Animal Aid, a role you devoted yourself to for 22 years. When and why did you first become interested in animal rights?
It began with a strong surge of conviction, but it's not always easy to pin down where this comes from and why it becomes so all-consuming. A road that has to be followed. One of the moments I tend to identify is the experience of witnessing a little bird trapped in the office where I worked as a 16-year-old. It was the early 60s, right as the Cuban Missile Crisis, the nuclear standoff between communism and capitalism was coming to a head. On the day we expected the bomb to go off, I watched helplessly as a little bird tried to escape from the ground floor entrance of an office block she'd strayed into. I worked in the building as a filing clerk and tea boy. Over and over, while people waited for lifts, she flew at the glass panel above the open door, trying to bust through. The pain and bewilderment experienced by that little bird was for me, in that moment, more terrible than the thought of atomic warfare itself, in which millions of birds, millions of children would die or be left burnt and broken. And I remember being conscious of the powerful effects this one little bird was having on me, being able to shake me up so deeply. And all I can say is things like that stay with you. They change you. It begins with a strong emotion that fills you up, and eventually, that emotion, or the meaning behind it, comes to dominate everything. Intellect, career, ambition.
Why do you suppose it was the bird situation that upset you so much? Could those same feelings have been triggered by seeing another animal in peril?
I don't know. Perhaps it's about chance moments, times when you're receptive. The bird episode, as I say, happened in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we were all getting ready for the end of the world. So you could say I'd been softened up. One can look for events and milestones to explain and put shape to what is that overtakes you. But I'm not sure that there's any shape to it. A simple fact is that people involved in animal rights are highly sensitive to the suffering of other creatures. All the more so because society refuses to recognize it. We're mocked for our feelings and made to feel weird, as if it is some sort of pathological state. Yes, perhaps a lot of us have early lives marked by violence or rejection or other experiences that have somehow sensitized us. It's easy for lazy critics to label our beliefs as pathological, but if compassion and determination to correct injustice arise from a pathology, then it's a very healthy sickness that we have.
You worked as a journalist for many years, first as a reporter on trade magazines, later as a music industry specialist, and finally an investigative reporter on titles such as The Independent, Time Out, The Observer, and The Guardian. How did you come to write in the first place, and why the switch to animal rights issues?
I think I first developed an ambition to write and express myself because I spent a lot of time when I was a kid growing up in an orphanage, being shy and nervous and not speaking that much. I didn't have much formal education. I was still 14 when I left school, but went on to get a job as a junior reporter in the trade press. I learnt the basics of writing in that job, even though the subject matter wasn't particularly exciting. When the opportunity came to focus on an issue that had real meaning for me, it was music. It always was music for my generation. Many of us saw it as the perfect vehicle for achieving big-scale cultural and social change. For a number of years, I worked as a rock music writer, which was fun, but ultimately, you're in the business not of social change, but of promoting a pretty flaky and superficial industry. So, I was left with a big question. What is important to me, and how can I express it? The answer, in plain terms, is the abuse of power by those who've got it, and the price paid by those at the bottom of the pile who haven't. And, of course, at the very bottom of the pile of have-nots are animals. In terms of the writing style, it always made sense to me to employ a strong narrative element to engage people and illuminate issues. That's because the world is changed, not through rhetoric or demotic declamations, but through inspiring people. I was used to telling people stories in the press about dramatic subjects such as knife crime, kids living rough on the streets, dodgy landlords and the like. My aim was to keep the reader reading. Where animals were the subject, my goal was exactly the same.
If you had wanted to concentrate exclusively on animal stories, would that have been possible?
I was keen to do more animal stuff from my earliest days on what was Fleet Street. As I said, I'd been a vegan since 1983, but I knew that if I pushed too many animal stories on commissioning editors, they would soon get wary of me. I think I balanced things out and managed to place quite a few strong animal pieces over a roughly 10-year period. As well as the realities of animal farming and slaughter, there were pieces on zoos, the pet monkey trade, the use of animals in genetics, research, city hunting, pheasant shooting, that type of thing.
Which area of animal suffering concerns you the most or demands most attention?
Comparisons, as they say, are invidious, but in terms of scale, it has to be animal farming and slaughter. It is such a vast and utterly cynical enterprise. Cynical for the way it processes animals as though they are mere objects, but generates all this phony stuff about animal welfare being their first concern. The animals locked inside their economic models are commodities. In some ways, apples are treated better. Bruised apples don't sell. Bruised and blooded animals do. They have to be more careful with apples. The suffering of farmed animals begins with their birth and continues to their final moments in a slaughterhouse, where they're shackled upside down and have their throats cut. There is also the fact, and this is not often discussed, that most farmed animals have no experience of their mothers or anything resembling a natural start. Instead, they are the product of industrial hatcheries and artificial reproduction techniques. The youngsters are brought together as an anonymous mass in rows of cages or in sheds, holding thousands at a time in the case of chickens reared for meat. In fact, millions of those animals will die before they ever get to a slaughterhouse. They die from disease in farm fires and floods and in vehicle crashes. At Animal Aid, we undertook a detailed analysis of this phenomenon and called the report The Uncounted Dead. One of the cases we highlighted related to two adjacent Lincolnshire chicken farms owned by the same company. They were built knowingly on a floodplain, which indeed did get flooded in December 2013. Around 700,000 chickens drowned on the two farms. And yet, with barely a pause, the owners reconstructed the business on the same site. Based on industry and other statistics, we came up with a figure of 44 million farmed animals dead each year before they can be slaughtered. The total annual number slaughtered is nearly 1 billion. That's in the UK alone.
An investigative piece on animals that caused a considerable stir was your description of pigs being taken to and then killed in a slaughterhouse. Can you tell me about that?
It was published March the 13th, 1989. I talked my way in by saying it was for a book I was working on, and then describing the book in benign terms. When I saw the nature of the place these pigs had been brought to, the blood and foul water and men with scabbards of knives and leather aprons, everything streaked with blood, it was like a scene from hell. While I was there, the police came, and though I wasn't so naive as to think they were going to arrest them all for killing pigs, there was something unreal about their visit. They'd had a report of stolen wheels from a car, so they rushed in to try and apprehend the thief. And I thought, animals who want to live are being killed here, and yet the police have mobilised for some hubcaps. What kind of back-to-front world is this? The Independent ran the piece big in the middle of the paper, and it produced the largest mailbag they've ever had for a single issue. It was later reprinted in two or three books and provoked a debate in Parliament.
Why do you suppose it had the impact it did?
Because what I described was both very shocking and new to most readers. I too found the experience extremely distressing. I kept it together while I was there. In the evening, though, I did shed some tears. A lot of the impact came from the straight, factual account I gave of what I saw. It needed no embellishments, because the sights and sounds and palpable feeling of animal terror in that place were so strong. The whole thing of looking and bearing witness is crucial for our movement. And when we return with the evidence, our aim must be to shape it the very best way we can, and then tell a story that moves people. We have to try to do what an accomplished filmmaker does, make people really see and feel what's going on.
How did national newspaper editors react to your animal stories?
One or two of them were very good in the way they gave me space, for instance, to challenge head-on the science establishment over its wasteful and cruel obsession with genes and all the animal experiments that go with it. They also ran my pieces that were strongly critical of zoos, which I see as stone prisons full of depressed, sickly animals, but which are touted as making a major contribution to species conservation. In fact, the majority of animals in zoos are not endangered, and introducing them to a natural habitat in the wild almost never works because zoo animals are too institutionalized to survive, whether prey or predator species. So it worked nicely for a time, but towards the end I became a bad fit for the papers. Editors don't mind their writers having an angle, so long as they don't actually disrupt the status quo. Let's face it, if animal rights were to become real rather than an aspiration, it would be dislocating to the whole social, economic and cultural order, which is not to say there won't be rich culture and commerce in a post-meat world. But editors don't want writers with disruptive imaginations. They will give space to radicalism to an extent, but only the kind that leaves the existing order unruffled. This makes you hesitant when you begin writing a piece, because you're trying to second-guess them. In the end, I knew I couldn't carry on with it, but I had a good innings with dozens of substantial stories on animals getting published.
So you chose Animal Aid. How did you first become involved in that organisation?
I did a major piece for Time Out in 1987. Covering vivisection, hunting, fur, food and the animal rights movement itself. Animal Aid's then director, Mark Gold, was an important source of information while putting it together, and its publication happily coincided with Animal Aid's first Living Without Cruelty exhibition. Following on from that, Mark said, "Why don't you do something for us?" I decided to do an investigation of livestock markets, which led to the establishment of Market Watch, a wonderful network of local activists. The bullying and thuggery towards the animals badly needed to be exposed. It was a terrible thing to witness. Cattle beaten with sticks with nails in the end of them, and tiny exhausted calves a few days old being loaded into transporters for live export to the continent. There could be funny moments, mind you, like in Guildford Market when my camera bag was spotted in the sheep auction area. The guy on the mic started berating me, saying I was creepy and dishonest. Like a lynch mob in the old movies, the men on the bank seats began reflecting the auctioneer's amplified irritation with me. My response was a touch surreal. I called out to the man on the mic, "You do your job and I'll do mine," and sat down to several minutes of sheep bidding before deciding I'd best get out of there. After delivering the market report to Mark, I was drawn in bit by bit. I worked as campaigns director for a year under Mark's very valuable tutelage with a view to taking over as a director. And that's what happened. At that time, the main campaign issue was vivisection, along with farming and diet. The ones I introduced later were shooting, horse racing, and wildlife culls.
How did it feel when you stepped into the director role?
I've never really talked about this, but I'd suffered with a fairly serious anxiety syndrome for years. Something that I'd had on and off from childhood. How I thought I could cope, I don't know. I can say it now. I'd be lining up for my morning paper in the newsagent behind people, dreading the moment I reached the till and I'd have to speak. And that was while I was at Animal Aid. Yet, at the same time, I was prepared to go on the ITN or BBC News. It's amazing what you can do when you have to. My desire to do it, to be useful, and to use what I had, ultimately proved stronger than my anxiety, though it didn't feel like that at the time. Weirdly, it was when my symptoms of Parkinson's came on about 10 years ago that the anxiety faded, and then eventually disappeared. The weaker and more faltering I became physically, the stronger my mental condition.
What were your first moves at Animal Aid?
Mark had put in place so much that was valuable, including a paid-for headquarters building. But one of the things I knew I had to do urgently was to get the internal infrastructure sorted. The computers would break down when we were trying to print press releases or in the middle of a big mail-out to supporters. We were so constrained that there was even a suggestion that we drop our quarterly campaign magazine, Outrage. "We can't do that," I reasoned. "It's the main way we communicate with the world." This was before the internet, of course. So the first 6 months was about getting the hardware sorted, getting in shape physically, while at the same time monitoring spending. The next period was about reaching out more confidently with our campaigning, doing it more boldly because we knew we had the physical support structure, and that worked.
Was Animal Aid a vegan organisation when you joined?
Before I joined, the dairy trade was recognised by Animal Aid as an evil and something to be opposed. The same was true of the egg business. As I said earlier, comparisons between different types of cruelty and exploitation often don't take us very far, but poor old dairy cows do get a very raw deal. They are selectively bred to produce hugely unnatural quantities of milk, as a consequence of which they are plagued with painful udder infections and lameness. It's increasingly common to zero graze them. In other words, rarely, if ever, let them have their sheds. They get depressed, they are in pain, and then comes the ultimate betrayal. The calves they were made to carry for 9 months to produce lots of milk for human beings. Those calves are stolen from them soon after birth. It's a wicked old business.
When did veganism become the central campaigning element of Animal Aid?
For years, the accepted wisdom was to promote vegetarianism as a stepping stone to veganism. We wanted the quickest route to changing people's hearts and habits, and we made a calculation that if you shout vegan at some people, they get the bends. But even during the years we ran Veggie Month and offered veggie information packs, all the recipes and advice in them was vegan. We stepped things up in 2007 when we launched Vegan Month and began the final phasing out of Veggie Month. I personally was immensely relieved to be unequivocally promoting a wholly non-animal vegan diet. In fact, the vegan message was relocated centre stage of the whole Animal Aid enterprise.
How important is your anti-vivisection campaigning? And how difficult is it, considering that there is a large scientific and technical component?
Campaigning for an end to vivisection has over the years provided great dramas and challenges. Animal Aid has stayed the course, and we played a central role in an especially famous victory, defeat of the plans by Cambridge University to build a massive research centre specialising in neurological experiments on monkeys. It started as a local campaign, and then we took it on and gathered together different groups and individuals to present a powerful case at a government-appointed planning inquiry that was charged with considering the merits or otherwise of the scheme. The inquiry ran for nearly 2 weeks, starting on November the 26th, 2002, and we won. The government's planning inspector ruled against the project on medical and scientific grounds, as well as those relating to Greenbelt encroachment and public order. In January 2004, Cambridge abandoned the project. There was always plenty to do on the vivisection front. When I was fitter, I gave speeches all over the country, including at anti-vivisection demos, opposing one dark scheme or another. We produced a great many sophisticated, fully referenced scientific reports. We met routinely with top Home Office officials and politicians and took part in and staged demos. Where we could, we have worked with other groups, and we have not been shy of taking on powerful interests. Before I left, the focus was on research charities such as the British Heart Foundation and Cancer Research UK that fund vivisection. In addition, we were tackling the huge amount of invasive animal experiments conducted by the Royal Veterinary College. I believe we also have to sound a general warning about the narcissistic tendencies of biomedical science and its presumed right to pursue what it regards as the truth, irrespective of the cost to the multitude of animals who are used as its experimental raw material. In many ways, science has replaced religion as the new faith, except that it regards itself as superior to the old one, because, as I say, its concern is not with the right and wrong, but truth. And truth is arrived at, it will say, by gathering evidence using the scientific method. The problem with that line of thinking is what constitutes evidence and truth is disputed among scientists themselves, which is why the scientific method is not an infallible problem solver or truth finder. It is merely a mechanism for seeking answers, besides which most scientists do not serve the truth. They are servants of commerce.
Can you talk a bit about how you collaborated with external consultants on campaigns at Animal Aid?
I think our horse racing campaign has been exemplary, because through original research in the work of our uniquely well-informed consultant, Dean Stansel, we have exposed some ugly secrets about this heavily romanticised industry. We have shown that roughly 180 horses die on racecourses every year, and a larger number die in training or are killed because they're no longer commercially viable. And we have exposed a serious lack of provision for horses when they finish racing, resulting in hundreds being sent for slaughter every year. Through hard, imaginative work, we have succeeded in changing public perception and media coverage of racing. Our campaigning on this front began modestly. You could say we were goaded into going hard at it, every day of the week by a drunken national newspaper racing correspondent who, after receiving our press release about the three deaths in the 1998 Grand National, sent us an email which told us to fuck off until next April, when the next Grand National would be staged. I looked at Dean and said, "They think we're playing at this as part-timers. We're going to have to show them how serious we are." When in 2006, 11 horses died at the then three-day Cheltenham Festival, the whole thing was blown open, and we were ready with all the data and the informed contacts. In fact, a year later, we launched our online database called Racehorse Death Watch, which aims to expose and record every on-course thoroughbred fatality in Britain. That's something the horse racing authorities have refused to do. Death Watch gives the names of killed horses, where the fatality happens, who was riding the horse, and the nature of the injury. It is particularly popular with racing journalists. Dean was perfect, because he understood the triggers to the equine deaths, the integral weaknesses and risk elements that were built in during construction of a racecourse to maximise the thrills and spills. It's a particularly cynical industry. Another important campaigning issue for Animal Aid is the shooting of birds for sport. This is something that I started focusing on soon after we moved to Tunbridge in 1995. triggered when Sarah and I witnessed a group of men standing in a field shooting at a flight of ducks, circling and trying to get back to their nests. The ducks kept coming back to what was their home, and the men kept shooting them. In the office, there was a bit of resistance from one or two people at first because it was a new issue for us that we didn't know about. But my answer was, let's find out. And what we found out is more than 50 million birds a year. Pheasants, partridges and ducks are bred for sport. In those early days, as with the horse racing issue, people didn't know. The national media didn't know that such vast numbers of birds were being purpose-bred just to be shot. We got lots of media coverage of the issue, but the shooting industry, after being wounded by the initial attacks, started that endless process of elaboration, justification and excuse-making that all sectional interests take up when they're under scrutiny. Kit Davidson, who was to become our shooting consultant, turned up in a Guardian article. He'll admit it, he was a NIMBY. They were trying to expand a shoot in his part of North Wales, and he had fought them and won. Kit's an ex-Navy man, very establishment and upright. I remember during one of our early phone conversations, he said, "Sorry, be with you in a minute, Andrew, I've got some bacon on the go." But he did become a vegetarian in the end. He's been very good on things like tax and rates. Through his research and persistence, he was able to identify VAT and rates unpaid by the shooting industry, something they often got away with by pretending to be in farming rather than sport. An additional $13 million was collected as a result of Kit's briefing to one regional tax office. And following his lead, Animal Aid has identified numerous pheasant and partridge farms around the country that were not paying rates. Kit has always been easy to know, but in terms of the deeper connection, he came on side gradually. It was a culture shock for him, I suppose, but I've always believed you've got to work at drawing all sorts of people with talent and experience towards the collective endeavour, even if at first it feels a little awkward. If we cleave to each other, cult-like, then we're not fully part of the world.
Talking of being part of the world, does Animal Aid mostly confine itself to campaigning on home shores?
Yes, we do, although we recognise we are part of a world community. I was particularly proud of what was our opposition to sending gifts of animals to impoverished communities in Africa. This was tricky territory because there is no more vivid an example of enfeebled, helpless humanity than starving communities in Africa. And we were saying, don't give them aid in the form of animals. But there is a very good reason. Animals are an inefficient way of producing food to feed people. Cut out the animal and you can do it far more efficiently. Even in marginal, inhospitable land in Africa, our argument holds. Land that looks as if it can't support anything can often support people without animals. I'm thinking of communities just south of the Sahara Desert who live principally on fruits from trees and bushes that grow naturally in this arid area. And when land can't support people, it can't support animals either, not as a sustainable food resource. I was proud we took on that issue. We generated huge amounts of television, radio and press coverage, and a great deal of discussion.
Can you explain why undercover work has been such an essential part of Animal Aid's focus?
Any campaign group that effectively challenges the established way of doing things is going to face hostility and dirty tricks from what we might call the gatekeepers of the status quo. But where the truth is disputed, a covert camera can usually settle matters. It can also generate unforgettable images. Animal Aid was already doing investigations when I joined, but I knew we could do more. From the late 1990s, an urgent ongoing task for us was to help restore the reputation and credibility of the animal rights movement itself, which was then routinely characterised in the mainstream media as dangerously extreme and irrational. Equally, it was claimed that our descriptions of systematic abuse by, for instance, the farming industry, were invariably high on emotion and short on fact. Our answer was to employ a first-class lead investigator and to conduct undercover filming of a wide range of situations. Farms, slaughterhouses, livestock markets, pheasant shoots, game farms, vivisection establishments, and so on. Every bit of evidence that came out of these projects then had to pass through a strict test for accuracy and clarity. Could it be understood? Was it believable? There's a strong opportunistic element to undercover work. You need to welcome tip-offs, respond to complaints, and stay alert to any phenomenon or particular establishment that needs instant attention. In the bigger picture, undercover filming and associated subterfuge are deployed to support and help drive forward the strategic campaigning goals.
When you arrived at Animal Aid, did you already have a clear sense of how to manage an organization, a diverse group of people made up of an in-house team and external consultants?
No, not at all. You've got to remember, I was a hippie at heart. As a general rule, I had resisted fixed setups as much as possible in my career and had always wanted to do my own thing. When I came to Animal Aid, any notion of a rigid hierarchy would have been alien to me, and neither had I inherited that culture from my predecessor, Mark Gold. Having said that, I was once asked by a member of staff, "Can you draw us a chart showing who is above who?" My response was no, not only because these things are never actually that clear, but because I didn't want that kind of Big Brother message being beamed down at people. My instinctive approach was to try to be flexible and not to be scared off taking on people who were perhaps a bit combative or awkward, but still had something to offer. Up to a point, of course, you have always to think of the impact on staff harmony. There is a point at which judgment has to be exercised. Sometimes it was difficult, but we got through those times. My own role inevitably involved deploying what at times can be my rather chaotic creative energy, which has its drawbacks as well as its pluses. Perhaps I would have done better to be more orderly, more systematic, but then something would have been lost, and I think if you're going to provide leadership, your team have to see something authentic in you. People won't fully engage with a boss who comes across as prefabricated. I do, however, believe strongly in a strategic approach that involves establishing a goal and a prospective route to that goal. The calculation would include an assessment of your strengths and weaknesses and a similar assessment of the challenges you need to overcome or bypass. I find a good exercise is to try to think from the other side of the argument in response, say, to a planned initiative on your part. Might you be dragged somewhere you're not ready to go? Finally, on this subject, I believe it's vital we leave space and time to be creative. I would say that what this movement of ours can never have too much of is creative animus. That ability and desire to explain and describe things in ways that move people.
How do you think Animal Aid fits into the wider animal welfare and rights context now?
For me, it's always been essential that we keep in touch and retain the respect of grassroots activists. And that's been difficult in the past, particularly when there was a great deal of mistrust due to muddle and infighting over methods of campaigning. The reality is that we produce campaign and educational resources and are an invaluable source of expertise for activists at local level. But we need their help. We can't effectively reach into local communities and carry our message there without the engagement of local people. Despite the obvious benefits of collaborative working, there are some national groups in our movement who regard local campaigners as a hazard, likely to say something wrong or dangerous. But we are what we are as a movement. We're full of excellence and nuttiness, and that's exactly what gives us our force.
We've talked about your background as a journalist. How important would you say journalistic skills are to the future of organisations like Animal Aid?
There are two journalistic virtues that I think will remain essential: accuracy and what you might call economy of expression. If you put information out that is easily torn apart, you lose credibility. And that means you also lose the chance of your stuff being picked up by the wider media in future. Also, content that exaggerates and distorts is very easily spotted. Accuracy and precision are key. Take out all the words that don't matter, and that way you get urgency. Journalism at its best does that. People mock tabloids, but a well-written tabloid story in the Mirror, in the old days anyway, you got it in 50 words. If we're going to change the world, we have to apply craft. We've got to use all the powers at our disposal. Imaginative, descriptive, and not just be full of emotion that we don't know how to deploy.
Tell us about your weekends when you were a director.
Well, I'd have some time off, but being a director of what company law terms a small to medium entity means you're not sitting at the top pulling levers back and forth to control heads of departments. Someone leading an organization of this size has got to be on top of everything, especially if they're going to be a spokesperson. So I spend my time at weekends reading scientific papers, government reports, the farming press, maybe a draft article or press release produced by a staff member. It turned out that the weekends were a very good time to catch up. The staff need to have confidence in you, to know that you're following all the major threads. I made it my business to keep on top of the internal financial thing. I knew how much we had in legacies and how much each appeal earned, the surplus or the projected surplus or the deficit. Mary Shepherd, our general manager and my greatest ally over many years at Animal Aid, would oversee merchandise, although I'd want to be alerted to the ups and downs. And I kept in touch with our educational work through our excellent head of education, Mark White, and he would periodically come to me for advice. But with campaigns, I'd make sure I had a detailed understanding of all the main things we did, and that's a bit of a slog. When my Parkinson's began eating into my energy and causing pain, I pressed on. But my concern for many months was to hand over to a sound person who will keep the ethos going while doing their own thing and who, very importantly, the staff could develop confidence in. I was very keen for Isabel Hutchinson, recently appointed our head of campaigns, to take on the role. She's a very bright and able young person, but is a tough one because you know something comes on the radio at 10:30 at night. Tomorrow a new report will be published and you've got to be prepared. So you go onto the web to do some background reading to be ready in the morning. And when you get into the office, you might be greeted with an urgent staff crisis. But it's wonderful in the sense that you have something to focus on in life that's valuable and challenging and makes a difference if you do it properly.
If you closed your eyes and thought of one thing about your time at Animal Aid, what would it be?
I don't know. Locking up at night when everyone's gone, the phone call that says, "Would you like to be on Newsnight?" Marvellous laxative. The laughter and nonsense I'd sometimes hear coming from the campaign team that gave me such pleasure. This laughter, I should explain, is by way of releasing the enormous emotional pressures that build as a result of having to deal up close every day with graphic evidence of human beings' inhumanity to animals. There was a period when people in parts of the office weren't really talking to each other. And then suddenly they started up again, whereupon everything looked better and the energy returned. And that's the point. Creativity that achieves what we want and arouses people and inspires people doesn't come from exchanging emails. It's about interacting with each other in an open way. If we're having a formal conversation, I'd sometimes have a powerful urge to break it up by introducing some nonsense logic and see what comes of it. It's like the old cartoons with Tom and Jerry. You smash the clock and all the springs are bouncing everywhere, but the clock's still functioning. Break it up and start again and see what emerges. I love the working together because it's hard doing what we do without finding some togetherness. I feel enormously fortunate to have found that and to have been able to work with a group of such dedicated, compassionate and talented people. Animal Aid was like a quest fulfilled. My rainbow's end. The work completely took hold of me, possessed me. It made me nuts and it's been my saviour. People tell me I've done useful work. And if that's the case, what more could I want?
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
That was My Life as an Animal by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith. Produced by Tom Davidson and adapted for UK Health Radio by Monkey Nut Audiobooks. My Life as an Animal is available on Audible and audiobook sites. Be sure to tune in next time to hear more from this title. This audiobook is published by Monkey Nut Audiobooks in Hampshire, UK.